if you are standing up against this kind of leader, then expect that they will not sit idly by. They're going to attack you. And we know that. But I firmly believe that the right, what is right, true, will prevail against lies. And I believe that the Filipino people will always side with democracy. The Filipino people will always side with freedom. And the Filipino people will always side with our cherished Filipino values. So we should keep on standing up, because the moment we give in to the threats, we give in to the fears, then therefore we would lose by default.
That's Philippine Congressman and opposition member Gary Alejano. Up next on the All Things Risk podcast. Welcome back to the All Things Risk podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I'm your host. This is my show, the show where we use the lenses of risk and uncertainty to explore a variety of topics, all with the aim of getting better at embracing uncertainty and to learn more about this crazy world in which we live. To all those of you who've been here before, welcome back and thank you. I'm very grateful that you are with us. Now, last week I said that we'd be back in 3 weeks, but that is obviously no longer true. And that's because what happened since then is I got this great opportunity to speak to today's guest, and I decided that it was better to get this episode out into the world sooner rather than later. But before we get into that, just a couple of things. First, as before, this episode is brought to you by Audible, the world's home for audiobooks. I personally love Audible. I listen to audiobooks quite regularly, particularly when I'm running or commuting, and sometimes that's the same thing. One of the things that I like about it is that you can sync where you left off in your audiobook with where you are with the same book in your Kindle. And the way Audible works is that each month you get credits that you can use to get an audiobook. The books are yours to keep. And if you are a listener to the show, you can get a free 30-day trial, which includes a free audiobook, which is yours to keep. Just go to audibletrial.com/allthingsrisk if you are in the USA, or click on the link in the show notes if you are in the UK. Second, I am running two online courses on decision making, one on November the 27th, if you want some training on making individual decisions. And on December the 4th, I'm running a similar course, but this time for small businesses and startups. Both are very reasonably priced. Check out the show notes and do feel free to share it with anyone who you think might be interested. Okay, let's get into it. This is a conversation about skin in the game. It's about leadership, democracy, geopolitics, and much, much more. My guest is Philippine Congressman Gary Alejano, and it's a conversation that reverberates across much of the world given the state of world politics and global leadership. However, I think it also reverberates because it is also about personal and collective values. It's about risk-taking and defending those values in the face of acute threats. Before becoming a congressman, Gary Alejano was a soldier in the Philippine Marine Corps and risked his life many times in various combat operations. He was awarded the Medal of Valor for his service to his country. In 2003, he was one of a group of young officers that led a mutiny to protest corruption in his country's armed forces. Yeah, I said this was about risk-taking. This mutiny was known as the Oakwood Mutiny. It was named after the hotel he and his co-mutineers occupied, And it was an incident that received worldwide attention. I actually was living in Manila at the time and was just down the road when it occurred. And it led to some reforms, but it also led to Congressman Alejano and his colleagues being detained for 7 years. And we talk about that. We also talk about his becoming a congressman, opposing his president's war on drugs. That's Rodrigo Duterte's war on drugs, which has led to the deaths of over 20,000 people in the Philippines by some estimates. And we talk about that. We talk about what's happening inside the Philippines, fake news, democracy, authoritarianism, China, and geopolitics. Congressman Alejano's run for a Senate seat next year, and taking acute personal risks in public life. I think you'll learn a lot from this conversation. It's one that transcends borders, and I came away firmly of the view that Congressman Alejano is one of the world's good guys. So let's go and meet Gary Alejano. Congressman Alejano, Gary, welcome. This is the All Things Risk podcast, and we're going to talk about some risks to democracy and the Philippines and a whole bunch of very interesting things, but welcome.
Thank you, Ben, for having me in your program.
So I want to delve into a number of very interesting topics, but before we do that, could you tell my listeners who come from all over the world, who are you? What is your background?
Well, before I joined the Philippine Congress, I was a captain of the Philippine Marine Corps. I graduated from Philippine Military Academy in 1995. Then I joined the Philippine Marine Corps. I was assigned in almost all parts of the Philippines, especially in the southern part of the Philippines called Mindanao, where I was exposed to fighting the terrorist Abu Sayyaf, the Moro Islamic Liberation Front, and the New People's Army. So I was involved in the all-out war against the MILF in the year 2000 during the time of President Erap Estrada, where I almost died there. I was wounded in action, but fortunately I survived that. And because of our, experiences in the field, where our, poor Filipinos are suffering from poverty, injustices, because I've asked myself why we continue to kill each other for, 5 decades now. So it opened my eyes on the realities on the ground where the lack of services of the government given to the people, led the people to rebel against the government. And these root causes should be addressed rather than killing them. So eventually, together with my colleagues in the armed forces, mostly my classmates from the Philippine Military Academy, staged a protest against the administration of Gloria Macapagal Arroyo in the year of 2003. And we occupied a hotel in the business district in Manila, in Makati, where we aired our grievances involving our organization and the government as a whole. And long story short, we were detained because aside from the fact that we agreed to step down when they promised to address our grievances, the government reneged on the agreement. So we were detained. And we were detained for 7 years, from year 2003 to 2010. In our quest for answers to the problems of our country, later on we decided to join politics inside detention. So the first person who joined the politics, because he was the face of the organization, the Magdalo, being the spokesperson of the organization, Senator Trillanes ran for office in 2007, then Lieutenant General grade of the Navy. And he won the elections. He won a Senate seat in 2007 while inside detention, without experience in politics.
Wow. Where were you detained?
We were detained inside the camp. Mm-hmm. We were detained in different detention centers. Mm-hmm. First,
they didn't want you together.
Yes, first in the intelligence service of the armed forces of the Philippines inside Camp Aguinaldo, the general headquarters, and later on we were transferred to Fort Bonifacio in the Marine camp, and later on we were transferred to the police detention center in Camp Crame. So after elections, we were encouraged to move on because the subject of our desire to serve is the people. And since they've gave us the mandate to serve them, we organized a mass-based organization inside detention. And finally, when we got out in 2010, because of the amnesty granted to us by the next administration after Gloria Macapagal Arroyo, we were released from detention. And in 2013, we joined the elections in the Philippines, in the party list elections, because in the Philippines we have two kinds of representation. Mm-hmm. One by geographic area, we call the district, and the other one is through sector or minor political party. So in my case, I represent the former and retired members of the Armed Forces of the Philippines and the Philippine National Police. Okay. So in 2013, we garnered enough votes for two seats in Congress. So together with my colleague, Congressman Francisco Acidillo, we served Congress, 16th Congress, from 2013 to 2016. And then in 2016, another election, we were able to get only one seat, and that's what I represent. So this is already my second term in the Philippine Congress, representing our sector.
Okay. I'd like to delve into a lot of that, particularly the mutiny in 2003. But before we do that, did you always want to serve in the armed forces?
Yes, it's my dream since I was in high school, because in our province, in the central part of the Philippines, province of Negros Occidental, we were placed under no man's land. I think that was in 1989, and I was a witness to the atrocities that happened there. A lot of people were killed.
What happened?
Because that place was placed under no man's land, so that means anybody
can go and claim land.
No. The certain areas in that part of the province should be cleared of residents.
Okay.
And anybody who are caught inside that inside that area could be considered as enemy of the state. So if you're found there, even if you are not a rebel, then you're subject to manhunt. Yeah.
Okay. So that experience prompted you, or somehow had inspired you, to serve your country?
Yes, because I believe that I would be able to serve my country by serving the armed forces. That's the reason why I took up the entrance examination of the Philippine Military Academy, and I passed in 1991. So I entered the academy in 1991 and graduated in 1995.
Okay, you talked a lot about, or you saw a lot of the conflict. For my listeners who don't know that much about the Philippines, sometimes they've maybe have heard about the Abu Sayyaf or the MILF, but can you explain some of the things that you saw, and then you talked about the root causes of what you saw. Could you dive into that a little bit more?
Yes, the Philippines was under the the United States as a colony of the United States, and we were given independence after the Second World War in 1945, although we had a Commonwealth government before that. There were already rebels in the Philippines, but got united with the Filipino people during the World War II against Japanese. Mm-hmm. So after the war, the Philippines was governed by Filipino people, but the rebels continued to exist. Then, as far as I can remember, the long-running insurgency in the Philippines is still there. It started in late 60s, in 1969, 1968, when the Communist Party of the Philippines was founded together with the New People's Army as its armed wing. And along with that formation of the Communist Party of the Philippines, the Moro National Liberation Front in southern Mindanao was also founded almost at the same time with the Communist Party of the Philippines. So we have insurgency all over the country, and the Moro National Liberation Front was focused in the southern part of Mindanao because they wanted independent Islamic State in Mindanao, because they believe that that Mindanao has never been occupied by colonizing forces from Spanish time and by the Americans. So they believe that they are not Filipinos and they deserve to be called, you know, Bangsa Moro. Up to now, we have that issue in the southern part of the Mindanao. So because of the increased violence and atrocities that happened from the late 60s towards early 70s, it prompted then President Ferdinand Marcos to declare martial law covering the entire country. So, you know, that martial law lasted until 1986. So it was during the time that, the Philippines was placed under the military control with the President Marcos. There were so many human rights abuses that happened during the time. And it was, you know, after almost 30 years of dictatorships, it seems that we're sliding back to dictatorship again by the election of President Duterte in 2016. So because of those experiences by the Philippines, the root causes of inequity, landlessness of most of the Filipino people, and unequal distribution of wealth, and the lack of basic social services given to the people, and they believe that we're being manipulated or controlled by foreign countries, especially the United States at the time, and also controlled by the oligarchs, few people controlling the resources of the government. So rebellion persisted for the longest time. And in 1986, the Marcos regime was toppled by the people power.
So the Marcos regime wasn't able to defeat these insurgents.
In fact, it aggravated the situation in the Philippines, because in their desire to silence and to control the opposition forces, including the rebels, it created two more problems, because a government that does not listen to its people will certainly encounter more problems. So in 1986, when the Marcos regime was removed, was toppled, it was replaced by the Aquino administration. So we regain democracy, we regain freedom. But of course, after so many years and corruptions continue to haunt the government, which resulted to incompetent service, and corruption in the government continued to persist as well. maybe the Filipino people got tired of this and maybe they wanted to experiment on some other system. Mm-hmm. So they got tired of politicians. It's the reason why they've been looking for solutions to the problems. And when Duterte presented himself as somebody who is outside the political circle mm-hmm. of the capital of the Philippines, Manila, he's from Davao, the southern part of the Philippines, when he presented himself as, simple, sincere, and has the political will to address the problems of the country, the Filipino people gambled in trying to, you know, elect that kind of president or politician. And that's the reason why we are now reaping the consequences of our gamble.
Before we dive into some of the more recent history of the Philippines, and there's so many comparisons you could make between the Philippines and what's happened recently in Brazil, for example, what's happened in the United States. You've spoken out and acted out against corruption throughout your public life, and I'd like to like you to maybe go back to the mutiny of the 2003 and talk to my listeners. If you could tell them a little bit about what was happening and a little bit more about what you decided to do and why and and particularly, you know, that's a risky thing that you did.
Yes,
you could have faced all kinds of consequences.
We could have died. Well, it all started when we were still cadets in the Philippine Military Academy. It opened our eyes on the realities of our country, because at that time, some graduates or alumni of the Philippine Military Academy were involved in corruption. So we asked ourselves why such thing happened. And we realized that it could also happen to us because we're molded in the same institution, we're taught of the same ideals, and we would be exposed to the same environment, and we would be promoted in the same, you know, career ladder. Most likely we'll end up like them in the future. So we discussed among ourselves, especially our classmates, members of class of 1995, what we should do in order to avoid that in the future. So we committed to ourselves not to commit acts of corruption. We should live a simple life, and we should serve our country well. And we should continue to meet with each other, continue to support each other, because the moment one is isolated, he could, be frustrated and, might prompt him to resign from the service, or if not, be eaten by the system.
So if how does that happen? How can that happen, being eaten by the system? Does it happen slowly?
Yes,
you
of course.
One step and then all of a sudden another step and another step and all of a sudden someone is consumed.
Because the perspective of a young lieutenant is different from the general. Because, you know, a lieutenant is somewhat I embrace that ideals, you know. But as he experiences the things on the ground, and he allows those things which he believes are not right or correct, then he starts to compromise. And as he goes up the ladder, he would experience the same things, and he will reach a point wherein he will decide on resources of the unit, resources of the battalion or the company or the brigade. In the moment he compromises again with that, he goes up again, then he will reach a point wherein he would believe there's no more problem because he's already part of the problem. So it goes slowly. So that's the reason why we committed to ourselves that as early as, you know, second lieutenant, fresh from the academy, we should be very aware of our actions, and we should, you know, shun corruption. We should resist that so that it will not eat us along the way. So with that opening of our minds, we experience or we saw other issues on the ground, like, you know, the corruption, the local government units, the, you know, the culture pervading in the you know, outskirts of you know, far-flung areas in the Philippines. So it led to our, you know, suffocation. So one major thing that really pushed us to protest against the government was when you know, we learned that some of the firearms and the ammunitions coming from the government were being sold to the enemies of the state. Mm. And that's corruption. They wanted to make money, but the thing that they were doing would result to the deaths of my comrades, would result to my death. So it was really ironic on our part to be serving the country and would be killed by our own arms and by our own ammunition. So we cannot take that. So also, there were other issues like, you know, at the time, the United States government was looking for their allies in trying to stop terrorists right from their own countries, from the source. That was after 9/11. Mm. So they would only support a country with a declared terrorist organization. So the Philippines at that time had no terrorist organization. Mm. So in order for us to receive support from the government, the Philippines should create one.
Right.
And you can only create one by creating some sort of scenario like a chaotic environment, like bombings, killings. There were bombings in the port of Davao Airport, pylons along the way, and there were some soldiers involved, and there were plans that we rediscovered. And you know, as a soldier who swore to defend and protect the Filipino people, it's you know, the end of it. Mm. We cannot take that. We're killing our own people because there were so many civilians who were killed at a time, innocent civilians. So we decided, you know, it's very hard to cross the line. Mm. You know, from an active officer or an active member of the armed forces to cross towards the other line where you will violate laws of the land and you would be killed. But our rationale at the time was that every time we go out of our patrol base or detachment, the chance of our death is already there. Mm. We could be killed anytime in the name of serving our country. So I think it's much more noble in trying to address the policy issue in the government, because that policy issue would result to whether good or bad. Mm. So we need to address that. So we decided to go out in the open and address the issue by informing the people that we are facing certain problems with the country, and that's our way of protesting, by wearing our uniform and bringing our arms. Mm. But we did not fire a single shot. Mm. We just protested and enumerated our grievances against the government. Mm. And the government promised to address them. Mm-hmm. So
that is the outcome you wanted.
Yes.
Yes.
So
I remember at the time people were saying this is a coup attempt, this is an attempt to take power.
Well, technically, it was not a coup d'etat, because a coup would be directed against government installations in order to weaken the power of the government. So, you know, in Makati, we took over a certain hotel, Oakwood, and it's a private entity. It's a private building. Mm-hmm. It is not a government building. And we did not attack anything. We just walked in and we just, you know, aired our grievances. Mm-hmm. So, but again, it depends on how you interpret it legally. But our objective really is to communicate to the people mm-hmm. that we are facing a problem and we should wake up. Mm-hmm. And we want to send the message so strong that mm-hmm. the government should react. Mm-hmm. And they responded mm-hmm. by addressing corruption issues inside the organization. It prompted reforms inside the armed mm-hmm. forces as well. Mm-hmm. They took notice of the combat equipment and clothing provided to the soldiers. So instead of holding the resources in the headquarters, they prioritized the front lines. So it resulted in some kind of reforms. They address also the certain group of people that controls the budget of the armed forces. So they addressed that, and also they took notice of our concern on housing program for our soldiers and medical attention and benefits that should be given to the soldiers. Mm-hmm. So I'm happy that at least it prompted some kind of reforms inside the organization. Mm-hmm. And I believe that our message is still alive up to now because it opened the armed forces to some sort of criticism and investigation. Because before, it's a closed organization, you cannot just, investigate the organization.
I suppose it raised the awareness.
Yes, it raised the awareness mm-hmm. that they should listen to the junior officers mm-hmm. Because they used to, during our time, they could say, wait for your time. You should be silent and follow orders. So this time around, they're more open to listening to junior officers and enlisted personnel who are exposed in the front lines. So those kind of reforms as well. Mm-hmm. So
I'm curious what your kind of assessment, your calculus was, because that was one outcome. Hmm. There was another outcome that, perhaps the a faction of the military could have attacked you guys and killed all of you. How did you come up with this plan? How did you assess what was the right thing to do?
We decided that right from the start we should not be there to kill our fellow soldiers. Mm-hmm. We're not there to attack camps. Mm-hmm. We're not there to destroy government buildings or private mm-hmm. Buildings. Mm-hmm. So we're there to air our grievances. We're there to defend ourselves. The moment the government attacks us, we should defend ourselves. Mm-hmm. But since they listened to our demands and the promise to address our grievances, so that's the end of it. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, it's not about us. Mm-hmm. It's about the people that we're serving. So if the government listens to you, mm-hmm. then that's good enough. But of course, it should be a continuing monitoring on our mm-hmm. side in order to make sure that these promises are complied with. But, specific parts of the agreement, that they will not file cases against us and they will not detain us, they renege on that because they detained us and they filed so many cases against us. So we suffered the consequences, and but of course we're willing to accept the consequences of our actions because right from the start we know that we would be violating laws of the land. Mm-hmm. But we were willing to take the consequences in order to send our message through. So we were detained for 7 years. Mm-hmm. And it was there when, we did not waste our time there. We equipped ourselves in a way, physically, mentally. We even, enrolled ourselves to, courses.
Okay.
I was able to finish my master's.
Okay.
Inside detention.
Master's
in public management.
Okay.
So I have to know how the government is being run because if I want to be part of the solutions, so I should be equipped on how to run a government. Mm-hmm. So it opened our minds, to, issues about the government. So we had discussions on how to solve problems in our country. And we had debate on whether to join politics or not. Because, you know, in the Philippines, the perception is already there that politics in the Philippines is really messy. It's really dirty. If you're a politician, you're assumed to be corrupt.
If it's not just in the Philippines.
Okay.
It's almost every country.
So it was a challenge to us because we don't want to be eaten by the system. We don't want to end up like those who went against, went ahead of us. So, but if we will not gamble, if we will not decide, then we would lose by default. So we decided to join politics in 2007 because we know that we can use our position or political space to pursue our advocacies for reforms. We can even make certain ways how to facilitate programs and projects for our constituents. And we can even influence policies like security sector reforms and modernization of our armed forces if you're part of the policymaking body. So
what in your in those that time of studying and ideas, what are some of the things that to improve the situation in your country, what were some of the priorities that that you had identified?
Well, we know that the problems in the Philippines are very complex. You know, it cannot be addressed overnight. And we don't pretend that we can solve the problem alone or solve the problems alone. We believe that we need the involvement of all citizens of the country. Because nation building is that cannot be done by the president alone or some people. It should be done together with all the citizens of the country. That's the reason why we set up a mass-based organization. We call that Samahang Magdalo, because we wanted them to be responsible citizens doing their share to the country by being a good citizen, by loving their country, serving the people, loving their family, you know, taking care of the environment, participating in elections but not selling their votes, you know, paying right taxes to the government, and by not bribing government officials. Or if you're a government official, you should not be bribed. And also being a good example to our fellow men. So those are the basic you know, code of conduct of the organization. And we're engaged in community activities in order to help for Filipinos, because we want to develop the heart of service among our members. So we initiated that inside detention. It was born inside detention. So our leaders, their volunteers, pretended to be our relatives because they could not go in if they're not related to us. They pretended to go in, and I conducted orientation about the organization and the objective of our organization. When they go out, they start spreading the word. And after 2 years, when we were released from detention, the members were already 90,000 members. So it was a movement, actually, in trying to develop some kind of culture. Culture of service, culture of competence, culture of excellence. So up to now, we're still doing that because I understand, we understand that the problems could not be addressed overnight. So even in Congress, even in the Senate, Senator Trillanes, who is my colleague, who ran in 27, is going to end his term this next year, 2019, is only one among the 24. And me is only one among the 294. So we can only do so much. We make sure that we're doing our part, and we have been consistently the top performers in both houses. And we continue to advocate for you know, good governance by doing a role as a fiscalizer of the government, because we believe that a healthy democracy is being achieved by having healthy opposition, because we need to to provide check and balance to our government. So we're doing that right now in this present administration. And I am proud to say that so far, we have maintained the you know, the commitment that we had before, that we should have certain limits when we're dealing with our office, because the moment you don't put, you know, boundaries to what you should do in government, then we would end up the same politicians that we hate before. So I can say that we've maintained that. We did not compromise ourselves. That's the reason why we always found ourselves in a difficult situation every time, every elections, because we don't have resources. We don't have resources because we don't steal money from the government. So we always bring our issues to the people, because you know, they can always help us. And I'm happy that they're always supporting us every elections. So that's the reason why it's just but proper to give them back the sincere service that we should give them, because they're the ones that, you know, gave us the mandate and nobody else.
Well, can we talk a bit about your president and the shift to authoritarianism, perhaps, that is taking, seems to be taking place? Which is a global trend, but one that that struck the Philippines 2.5 years ago, I think.
2016 of May.
Yes.
Well, our listeners should understand that our president right now, President Duterte, was a longtime mayor in a city down south, Philippines, Davao City. So he was a mayor for more than 2 decades there. And because of, you know, the security problems that all of the cities and municipalities were facing at that time, he instituted a strong arm rule by trying to eliminate the so-called menace of the society. But, you know, it turned out to be, you know, it was used to other purposes as well, to perpetuating power, of course. So he was, you know, a virtual dictator in Davao City. Nobody crosses his path. So it was a known issue in Davao that people are killed by the Davao Death Squad. It was actually investigated by now detained Senator De Lima when she was still chairman of the Commission on Human Rights. That's the reason why Duterte got back at her. So she was detained right now. So
she's the senator, was the
senator Laila De Lima,
who was accused, the most vocal critic of, of the president.
And she was accused of drug trading without a single gram found in her possession. Now, since I believe that since Duterte found his, you know, strategy working in Davao when he was elected as president, because that's what he promised the Filipino people, that he would be addressing the illegal drugs and criminality in the Philippines within 3 to 6 months.
That he sounds, promised that. Sounds yes. a bit unrealistic.
Yes. Yeah, we know that it's unrealistic, but the people believe. The people bought it. He promised to address.
And there's something appealing in all of that. I imagine, you know, when if there's a lot of corruption, it's similar to what's happened in Brazil recently. Huge amount of corruption, and something very seductive about one person coming in and saying, "I can fix everything."
Yes, but I must say that the Philippines is very resilient. Yes, we have so many problems. We have corruption in government. We have poor people. We have inefficient services. But I must say that during the time of the president before Duterte, we were already around 6 to 7% in our GDP. And the economy was going up already. So I must say that every administration has its focus. And I believe that the economy should come first, because all our problems is just a result of lacking resources, or lacking food on the table. And people just wanted to survive, and maybe they committed crimes just to survive, like illegal drugs, rebelling against the government. So, it was very tempting for the Filipino to gamble on that kind of promises for leadership. And, we accepted that. Being among ourselves, we accepted that it was the voice of the people. And we are in a democracy. The majority wins. So he was elected as president. We gave him the benefit of the doubt, in fact. But when the killing started, we cannot anymore take that. So we started to call out the attention of the government.
These are the extrajudicial killings of suspected drug users, drug dealers.
Yes, yes. And, you know, the killings on the streets did not happen as a coincidence of the policy pronouncements of the president. They did not happen out of nowhere. It was a result of the policy direction of the president, because in every opportunity, the president has been saying that is going to kill those involved in illegal drugs, and he condoned, he encouraged, even rewarded police personnel, authorities, if they kill those involved in drugs
without any evidence or obviously due process.
Yes,
nothing like this.
And he even said that if one of the members of the family is involved in drugs, you can kill him. Parents can kill your children. So he's instigating that.
What happens there is that if I, for example, I don't like my neighbor or something, I can just accuse him of being involved in illegal drugs, even if I don't know. I just yes. don't like my neighbor. So it can create all kind of distortions.
That is one of those unintended consequences of this war on drugs. And they came up with the list. They have this,
drugs list.
Yes, drug list. They have this so-called Tokhang strategy. Okay. Tokhang is composed of two words, Tok-tok and Hangyo. So this is a Bisayan term, which is the dialect of the president in southern part of the Philippines. When you say Tok-tok, you're going to knock on the door and plead to the suspect that you should stop doing it. But what happened really is it's not knocking on the door and pleading. They just list down those who are suspects together with local chief in that certain area. When they come up and draw up a certain list, then it seems that people accept the fact that when you're killed, then it's because you're
somehow justified.
You justify the killing because you're in the list.
How do they come up with the list?
We've been asking the government, how do you validate that? Because, you know, a local village chief can put your name in that list because you are a threat to his political career or a threat to his business or whatsoever. So they just come up with a list, and the police will coordinate with that.
In some ways, it's a way of institutionalizing the corruption that you've fought against.
Yes, and we're saying that if they are so certain that that person is involved in illegal drugs, then therefore they can always file a case. If they have validated that, then they can file a case. So if one of the speeches of the president, I've remembered that the reason why the drug addicts or suspects were killed, it's because of our faulty justice system. If you file case against a suspect, you can always post bail or be cleared by the court, because the judge can be bought. So if our problem is our justice system, then we should tokhang or address our justice system, not the manifestation or the result of this faulty system. Because at the end of the day, if you don't address the system and you are killing the result of that system, then after some time, the problem will continue to show up because you have not addressed the system. And one of the findings of other countries, like Mexico, Colombia, of the cause of the illegal drugs use and abuse is poverty. So we need to address that as well, because most of the people that were killed were poor people. They wanted to survive, they want to make money, and along the way they tried the illegal drugs and they got hooked to it. And when they got hooked to it, there's no program in the government, so there's no rehabilitation. And they get victimized by the government, by our government. So they're victims three times over, by poverty, by illegal drugs, and by our own government. So instead of doing that, cutting short of the system, they should have addressed our justice system to make sure that those who are guilty are really punished. And we should also plug the hole, the source of the drugs coming from outside of the country. So we have a porous border. We have 36,000 kilometers long coastline.
So where do most of the drugs come from?
Well, in our official investigations, the House of Representatives, coming from the police, drug enforcement agencies, the bulk of the drugs come from China. And
that's interesting, because your president is very is kind of close to China.
So what we're saying is that the president will readily order the killings of an ordinary Filipino, but he is not mad at those who are responsible in bringing in tons of chabu inside the country, and even passing through our own Bureau of Customs. We should have expected the president to really get berserk and mad to those responsible of bringing in tons of chabu in the Philippines. But I have not heard the president really getting mad about this issue. But those who are involved in drugs, ordinary people, one, two sachets of chabu.
So shabu is, it's like methamphetamine.
Methamphetamine, yes. It's the prevalent drugs, illegal drugs in the Philippines. So I must say that I am one with the president in trying to address illegal drugs in the Philippines. But I don't agree with the means on how to address these illegal drugs, because the prescription that the president is trying to prescribe the public, it's much more dangerous or destructive than the problems that we are trying to address. The president is destroying democratic institutions like the police, like the Department of Justice, our justice system.
How is he doing that? What is he trying to do?
An example, the Philippine National Police. Instead of equipping our Philippine National Police to be good investigators in trying to collect evidence of suspects and trying to catch dealers or addicts, they're now given the signal to kill. So instead of, for them to be good investigators, they're now good shooters.
Do they get rewarded for that?
Yes, there were reports that, aside from they're promoted and praised before the public by the president, there were reports that they were paid per head of killed suspect. And that's the reason why I filed an impeachment complaint against the president, And we've submitted information before the International Criminal Court because we believe that the president is committing a crime against humanity. Because as of now, we have thousands of Filipinos killed under the war on drugs. In the unofficial estimate, I think it already reached around 30,000 people killed under the war on drugs. And, you know, what we're afraid of is that this war on drugs is not really designed to address illegal drugs in the Philippines, because after 2.5 years of killing spree in the Philippines, you could still see tons of drugs coming into the Philippines. Are they not afraid of the president to be killed? Are they not afraid to be killed in the Philippines? So, in fact, the price of drugs in the Philippines decreased. So, chabu or methamphetamine right now in the Philippines is cheaper as compared before. That means we have oversupply of drugs in the Philippines. So,
it's curious, isn't it?
Yeah,
they're
supposed to reduce the supply of drugs significantly because of the killings, but they did not deter the coming of drugs to the Philippines. So there must be some sort of, you know, people are saying that the president is just trying to eliminate competition in the Philippines in order...
Competition on drugs, you mean?
On drugs? Mm-hmm. Well, I've heard about that, but it has to be validated. And they're trying to cut competitions and monopolize the supply of drugs in the Philippines because his son was accused of being involved. But he even defended his son. He said before that regardless of who is ever involved in drugs, even his son, he will kill anybody, including his son. But it didn't happen. So it's a known fact in Davao that his son was involved in that illegal activities. He was the one, he was reported to be in charge of the port in Davao. But again, I would be convinced if after 2.5 years of this, the illegal drugs and criminality went down significantly, but it did not happen. So that means your policy is not working. I think it's time for you to reconsider your strategy. We have been suggesting to propose some kind of a, you know, humane way of dealing with this problem. Because I've heard former President Gaviria of Colombia said that if you treat illegal drugs abuse purely as a criminal issue, it will aggravate the situation. It will not solve the problem. But Duterte lambasted Gaviria. You don't intervene in the affairs of the government.
The evidence on the wars on drugs, from whether you look at Colombia or Mexico or Thailand, demonstrates that they don't seem to work at all.
Yes.
When you criminalize not address the root causes, it just perpetuates and institutionalizes these things. It would would appear so. The experience of the Philippines simply confirms the experiences of other countries who've been through this.
Yes, and in Thailand's experience, I've heard that after Thaksin Shinawatra was deposed, the military junta investigated the war on drugs of Thaksin Shinawatra, and they found out that more than half of those killed in the war on drugs of Thaksin Shinawatra were not at all involved in drugs. Because you can always put the names of the people you don't like. So
right, it's a way of silencing opposition.
Yes, opposition. So it happened in Davao. At first, they're trying to convince the people that it is designed to eliminate menace of the society. And after some time, it was used for political purposes in order to silence your opposition. So I think it's happening in the Philippines right now because the war on drugs and because of the result of the graphic killings on the streets, people are afraid because their names might end up in the narco list. So the president does not follow due process of law. He can destroy your name before the public without validation. So that's problematic in the Philippines. So,
and you can see what he's done to, you know, the most vocal, his most vocal critics. He's jailed one senator, and he has issued a warrant of arrest to another senator, Trillanes.
Senator Trillanes, my colleague. He revoked the amnesty of Senator Trillanes, the same amnesty that we also availed, that I availed. So if he questioned the amnesty of Senator Trillanes, in effect, he's also questioning my own amnesty. But I think he did not do their homework, because Trillanes actually applied for amnesty, and in that application contained the admission of guilt. So it was found out in the court when the hearings were conducted that he indeed filed the amnesty. I was there together with him when we filed. Around 39 officers and enlisted personnel personally applied during that day, January 5 of 2011. Now, President Duterte is trying to undermine democratic institutions.
He's also issued, I think, a tax case against Rappler, which is Maria Ressa's media outlet.
Because Rappler has been reporting, you know, has been publishing articles that were against the president or criticizing the government of Duterte. So you could see that in the Philippines, those who are going against the president, trying to raise the issues about his policies, are being silent. So Senator Dilema was already detained of Trump up charges. And Senator Trillanes is being, you know, threatened of arrest because of the revocation of the amnesty. The church, which is involved in trying to preserve, you know, trying to preserve human dignity and preserve human rights, is also the favorite punching bag of the president. So he undermined also the Catholic Church in the Philippines and even the mainstream media, and trying to direct the attention of the people away from the sources of information, the church, the mainstream media, and even opposition, to his own propaganda machine, like bloggers and influencers in social media. And it created so much division in the Philippines. Because of this, the hatred, killing, blood, you know. So I have not experienced this before in the past administration.
How divided is the country now?
Well, they have been demonizing the opposition forces and trying to say that they're out there to destroy the government of Duterte. And in the process, they weaponize social media, including the people, and trying to you know, a curse, trying to demonize those who are expressing their dissent against the policies of Duterte. So even members of the family are fighting with each other, and even members of political parties are split up. So we have not been so divided before.
Where does this go, do you think? Where can it go? Does President Duterte want to declare martial law? And
well, he has declared already martial law in Mindanao. I think it's just a an example or an exhibit to the people from Visayas and Luzon. He's conditioning the minds of the people that he could declare national martial law anytime. So it was. It is also an opportunity for the president to be you know, close to the top brass of the military. He has been giving extraordinary attention to the military, which I suspect the purpose of which is to get their loyalty to him, because he believes that he could use the military in pursuing his own objective. So I support that, but it's a suspect for me. because any support that we give to the armed forces should not be sold to personal loyalty, because the armed forces should be the defender of the people of the state. And of course, right now, it's a challenge because the president can always say his piece before the public without being held accountable to what he's speaking before the public. So that's the problem, because consider public office as something that should provide examples and models to our citizens. It is not the case right now. The president can just do whatever he wants, and the people are, very observant. The president is so sensitive about criticism. That is why the people cannot just freely speak. But and that's what we're doing right now. We were trying to, provide check and balance to the present government. It's very challenging because the threat is very real. People are killed, including priests, including politicians. Some are detained. So it is not really encouraging to be part of the or member of the opposition in the Philippines.
What's the role right now, do you think, of China in what's happening in the Philippines? Beyond we talked a little bit about the drug issue, but what geopolitically, China appears very close to Duterte.
Well, I believe that China has compromised the sovereignty of the Philippines by, co-opting the present administration. The president has shifted from very close alliance with the United States to almost subservience to China. And that's the question. Why is he doing that? In fact, of our favorable ruling from The Hague, of, it showed to the world that China has no entitlement on the islands in Cispratlys, but China did not respect that, did not recognize that. In fact, right now, they're laying claims to 80% of our exclusive economic zone. And the last administration was very costly to China, because the Aquino administration filed a case before the International Tribunal on the Law of the Sea. And it really hurt the reputation of China as a rising power. China wanted to maintain that reputation as a rising power, trying to provide leadership, trying to undermine United States' dominance around the world. And because of that, I believe that China intervened in our elections in order to capture political control.
And how did they intervene, do you think?
Well, by supporting the president.
Mm-hmm. And financially?
Well, I believe so. Mm-hmm. So it cannot conclude. Mm-hmm. It has to be validated. Mm-hmm. And the Communist Party of China has struck a memorandum of agreement with the party of the president. And I believe they're doing that in order to influence policies in the Philippines. Mm. Because in their A to AD strategy, area denial, the anti-access area denial strategy, anti-access, that means they have to deny their competitor, the United States, in politics, economy, and in culture. And that's what China is doing right now. They want to isolate United States away from policies of the Philippines, and they're trying to isolate United States away from our economy and culture. And you can see the demeanor of our president. Right from day one of his presidency, he already lambasted the United States. And he did not wait for the ruling when he expressed interest in going to China. He forgot that the ruling was about to be released, when the ruling was released on July 12, 2016, we did not celebrate. It seems we're the ones who lost the case. Mm. So we did not celebrate. And he went to China to appease Xi Jinping. And China pledged support to the Philippines to increase investment and promise of loans to the Philippines. And I believe that the build strategy of Duterte is really designed right from the start to connect with the Belt and Road Initiative in China. So that is what we're facing right now. A closer relationship with China, I have no problems with that, as long as it did not or it is not compromising our interest in the West Philippine Sea. Right now, we're very silent in the West Philippine Sea because they're trying to contain all information coming from the ground in order to paint a very beautiful picture of our relationship with China. But in reality, our fishermen could not freely fish in our own waters. We could not patrol our waters freely. In fact, our fishermen continue to face harassment from Chinese Coast Guard and Chinese Navy. And even our own security forces are being threatened. So you can only be friends to China if you agree with what they want. And China is establishing a norm there. Once it is cemented, you cannot reverse that. So what I'm trying to say is that we continue to talk to China, but at the same time, we continue to assert our rights by adopting a strategy, even a non-military strategy, to prove that we are serious with our claims in the West Philippine Sea. So it's a sellout on the part of the president, because if you're silent on our rights and you are willing to take in loans from China, that means you're selling out your rights there. So I've been warning the Duterte administration that we could fall into the trap which is adopted by China. This is the debt trap diplomacy of China. It happened already to other countries. We're about to enter the trap, because so far only one loan agreement was signed, and there are more coming. So they promised the Filipino people that the infrastructure projects funded by the loans coming from China would generate millions of jobs for the Filipino people, but it did not happen in other countries. Infrastructure projects funded by China employed Chinese laborers.
They bring their own workforce, don't they?
Yes. Yeah. And they've been looking businesses for their companies, and they're looking for jobs for their people. So they're trying to float the idea that we need technical experts from China. That is why we want to import Chinese workers from outside. And they're trying to condition the minds of the people. Because in reality, I believe that's one of the conditions demanded by China. We will provide you loans as long as you allow our workers to work on the funded projects. So the president is trying to tell the people that it is beneficial to the Philippines. Well, we need investment, yes, but we are not really a poor country. Our economy is resilient. In fact, we have surplus in our budget. When I say surplus, there are portion of our budgets which are not used or appropriated, and therefore, why do we need to borrow if we have, you know, budgets that are not used? So China is trying to pull the Philippines within its influence, and we're allowing that courtesy of this administration. As I have said earlier, there's no problem with us talking to China, but we should be very careful, because the actions of the president right now have long-term security implications to the Philippines. We have even opened now our third telco. Because we have two major players in the Philippines, Smart and Globe. And the president is opening third telecommunications, and he's offering that to China. The one that was qualified for third telco is his friend, businessman Dennis Oi, with a Chinese partner. So I think that is very dangerous, because it comes along security risk to our communication.
Well, there are already around the world concerns about Chinese technology in, for example, Huawei products in Australia,
the CTE,
and so on. So it does create some obvious concerns. What I keep seeing and hearing that President Duterte is incredibly popular, but is that true? Is that popularity slipping? I see that I know the inflation is high now.
Yes.
Is he losing his popular base?
Well, if you compare the ratings of the president when he started, definitely his popularity is slipping. Coming from almost 80 to 90%, mm-hmm. it's now down to 50%. And I believe that what's holding on to the ratings is maybe the atmosphere of fear. Mm. Because, I have not heard a dictator who is not popular in his country.
Mm.
He's popular because nobody wants to go against the dictator. In the Philippines, because of this fear factor, you cannot just say, I'm against the president. Because you could end up, your name could end up in the list of the narco list. Yeah. And if you have witnessed the killings around you, and you don't want to be identified as anti-Duterte, I understand that they would opt to play it safe, or you will say they agree with the president. Because you're afraid.
Mm.
So that explains the high trust ratings of the president, because we have been asking, in spite of all the things that's happening in the country, why is it that he continues to enjoy the high trust ratings by the people? But we try to investigate around, and the people are really afraid. Just imagine yourself, people approaching you, asking you whether you support the president or you trust the president or not. And you don't know that person.
Mm.
They could be intelligence forces of the police or the drug enforcement agency. You never know.
Mm.
And since you have witnessed the killings, you're afraid. You could decide to be silent. Mm. So, but nonetheless, even if assuming he has the high trust ratings, it will continue to educate the people of the real score of what's really happening in the country, because it's not only the Philippines, the proliferation of fake news and propaganda. So they have been poisoning the minds of the people even before the campaign in 2016, and it is still persisting up to now. They keep on producing fake
news.
Via
Facebook and
Social media. Mm-hmm. Yes. And, they have billions of pesos.
What role did that have to play in the election, do you think?
Well, although only around 37% of the information available to Filipino from our social media, but it's also a fact that around 67 million Filipinos are on Facebook. So they access information through their cell phones. So it's a big factor. It's a big factor, but at least right now Facebook has employed fact checkers on fake news, and many fake articles and sites have been reported already and were taken down by Facebook. And many of them were Duterte sites or supporters of Duterte. So it's a welcome development. But there's so many things to do still. I'm just saddened by the fact that Duterte succeeded in bringing out the worst in us. We are becoming violent, and we're becoming, divided people. And I cannot imagine Filipino cursing publicly, because it's not our culture. Even here in the United Kingdom, the supporters of Duterte are going out to the streets cursing those who are opposed to policies of the president. So for me, at the end of the day, Duterte will just pass away. That means his term will end in 2022. We are the same Filipinos working for our country. The very important part of our identity is our values. And we should not destroy that because of this temporary experience we're having right now. So we have so many things to do after Duterte.
That's a great way to start to... I think we we've been going on for some time, but we should probably think about wrapping up. But one of the things, I know you'll be running for Senate, and you've been in the public life. How do you just personally deal with potentially the risks associated with that?
Well, I understand that when I joined the military in 1991, 1995, I joined the Philippine Marine Corps. I know that anytime I could die. And if you're really sincere in serving the country, you should be brave enough to face the consequences of their action. It comes with a trade. If you're standing up against this kind of leader, then expect that they will not sit idly by. They're going to attack you. And we know that. But I firmly believe that the right, what is right, true, will prevail against lies. And I believe that the Filipino people will always side with democracy. The Filipino people will always side with freedom. And the Filipino people will always side with our cherished Filipino values. So we should keep on standing up, because the moment we give in to the threats, we give in to the fears, then therefore we would lose by default. So I love my country, and there are so many Filipinos who love our country. And it is just but proper for us to fight for it, even for our life.
I think that's a great way to end it. But, Gary, Congressman, thank you very much for spending some time with me.
Thank you very much, Ben, for the opportunity. God bless.
Right. I hope you all found that interesting. I found it fascinating. And I took two big things away from that conversation that I think are applicable to a variety of contexts outside of what you just heard. And the first has to do with personal values. As you heard from Congressman Alejano, his values guided his decision-making and his actions, and it allowed him and his colleagues to become more resilient to their detention. Of course, I'm not saying go out and lead a mutiny, but looking at our own values is a great way to help guide our decision-making. Secondly, I thought that the conversation highlighted the power of accountability. Congressman Alejano and his colleagues held each other accountable for what they said they would stand for. And I think there's great power in that. Check out the show notes as usual. That's it. But before we go, check out our two courses on decision making, November the 27th. And December the 4th. Links are in the show notes. And finally, I've started a newsletter as a complement to the podcast. It contains curated content from a number of useful, fun, and interesting sources. If you're interested in receiving that once every 2 to 3 weeks, sign up by going to allthingsrisk.co.uk. That's .co.uk. Thank you all for listening. We will be back soon in the interim. And as always, don't forget, risk is life.